Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. You are listening to NABWIC, the National Association of Black Women in Construction Blog Talk Radio Show, founded to increase the national awareness of black women in the construction industry. NABWIC is the charge and takes the charge for black women to advocate for further opportunities to its members. Our mission as a core foundation is to strengthen the building blocks of new educational, entrepreneurial, professional, and social network connections. The vision of NABWIC is to build long-lasting strategic partnerships with first-rate organizations and individuals that will provide groundbreaking and innovative solutions for black women in construction and their respective communities. We invite you to call or text or email family, business associates, or friends and tell them that we are on the air right now, or they can join us on the internet by logging in to www.blogtalkradio.com/NABWIC or by phone at 714-459-3918 and press 1 to join our conversation with questions or comments.
Good morning. This is Ursula Odom with NABWIC, and I am so pleased about today's show because we have an interesting guest coming up. And this is Wednesday morning. Every Wednesday morning, we have someone coming to you talking about their life and the construction industry. And today we have the awesome, as I understand, because I will get to know him as you will, Mr. David Moody. And David, welcome, and please introduce yourself to us.
Sure. My name is Charles David Moody, Jr. I go by David. I started C.D. Moody Construction Company 30 years ago. I graduated from Morehouse College with a degree in psychology, and then I graduated from Howard University with a five-year professional degree in architecture. I started my career in architecture with Bechtel Power Corporation. I took a field assignment, fell in love with the field, and decided instead of being an architect, I'd take my knowledge and go into construction. And as they say, the rest is history.
All right. So what actually got you interested in the industry at all? Who sparked the fire?
Growing up in Chicago, I'm a baby boomer. I'm 62 years old. So when I grew up, this was before technology had evolved. So we still had to do all our drawings by hand. And the older guys in my neighborhood, I used to see them with their portable drafting tables going to high school. And a lot of them were going to school to become draftsmen. And some of them would show me their drawings. And I always enjoyed playing with Lego building blocks and things like that. So at an early age, I knew I wanted to be in the design field, and I went to school for architecture. I thought I would be an architect, but two things happened. I realized once I started working as an architect, I would just be an average architect. But back then, we still had to draw every day, and I really wasn't an artist, but I loved the science of architecture and construction. And once I took that field assignment on the nuclear power plant that we were building, I just fell in love with the action, and I said, that's where my strength is. So I took the knowledge of architecture and the construction, but I had been wanting to do this since I was a little kid.
So did you have a role model? I mean, someone that mentored you throughout the process?
Well, let's just say when I was younger, back in the 60s, I had never even heard of an architect. I heard of draftsmen. But I had older guys on my street who I looked up to who would show me some of their drawings. I didn't meet my first black architect until I was 17. I was 17 years old. No, 16. I was 16. And we had moved from Chicago to Ann Arbor, Michigan when I was in ninth grade. And I met an architect, and he was my mentor. He had went to Hampton University during World War II. And he was my mentor who really taught me the importance of being a master builder, where not only drew, but you knew how to build.
Now, I'm curious to know, some of the things that he actually did with you. And the reason I ask is I had a friend who talked about his mentor quite a bit, and that person found him when he was a freshman in college and stayed with him throughout the entire 4 years and then became a lifetime friend. So that mentorship lasted for a lifetime. And the person pretty much poured everything he had into this young man and taught him everything he knew. He said, "You're not going to be a dumb person when you leave here." I mean, that was kind of funny, but that's pretty much what he made sure of. So what are some of the unique things that your mentor did that that you would say has lasted a lifetime for you?
Well, one, he just took time with me to teach me. I worked on a construction project with him. The other thing that I did that was very, very important, I also had another mentor. It was Dean Harry Robinson at the School of Architecture at Howard University. And he poured a lot into me while I was there. After I got out of school, we're still very close. My mentor died very early in my professional career. And I would say Dean Harry Robinson stepped in architecture school. So I had two mentors that were very, very key to me in the architecture and construction world. And I think the biggest thing was taking time for me to ask questions, share their journey with me, but just knowing they were available, is just being able to talk to them and ask questions. That's probably the best thing I got from them, was knowing they were there. I could pick their brain and gladly give me information.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you're from the old school, so that means that you're in a position to share the wealth. What are you seeing as it relates to young people in the industry now?
Well, I have three interns now, two from Tuskegee, one from Morehouse. I do a lot with young folks in the industry, but not just folks who want to be professionals, but I do a lot working with work-ready organizations and getting people ready to be in the field of construction as far as carpenters, laborers, electricians, plumbers. So I do quite a bit working with people who want to get the hands-on part as well as the professional end of construction.
Now, you mentioned Tuskegee, and that sparks something that was very interesting to me. I recently learned about Booker T. Washington and how he operated in terms of teaching those young people. He tried not to be controversial, even though he ultimately ended up being that. And he simply said he was teaching them how to fulfill the tasks that were needed at the time. But as it turns out, as far as brick making, as I remember, from what I understand, they actually created a method of curing bricks that had not been done at that point. And they had three attempts, and the third attempt actually worked, which meant that the people on that campus, Tuskegee Institute, were the only ones that could create the bricks in the way that they did. They were the master masons, I guess you would call them.
Right.
I may be wrong. Okay. And so it really made me have a lot of respect for him and how he taught those young people. So when you mentioned that school, I thought of Booker T. Washington and how shrewd he was in getting people to be masters at what they did, kind of like a sneak attack almost. Do you know anything about that school and Booker T. Washington as it relates to construction?
Well, quite interesting that you would ask that question. We renovated Tompkins Hall there about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was over 100 years old, and the students helped build that building, and they actually made the bricks. They fabricated the bricks that were part of the school. So I know a lot as far as Booker T. Washington was really good about helping people learn skilled trades. And I think, and I tell this to a lot of folks, if you like working with your hands, there is no better career than in construction and learning a skilled trade. I mean, many of the skilled craftsmen make 75 to over six figures, 75,000 a year to over six figures a year. And I personally believe technology will impact construction a little bit, but many of the trades will always need man and woman power to do it.
What do you see as some of the things that are coming around the corner as it relates to the future in construction?
Well, I mean, technology with computers have really picked up, such as BIM, where you can put buildings in 3D. You're getting 3D printers now. And you're seeing technology as far as being able with lasers and the trowel machines are able to laser finish. But at the end of the day, all of them are still ran by a person. But as far as on major big projects that we do, at the end of the day, it's still that good old craftsperson who gets it done. You know, technology helps with maybe scaffolding, layout, being able to take pictures of a situation in the field and email it directly to the architect or mark up a drawing on your iPad. But at the end of the day, it still takes that craftsperson to put it in. I will always admire and respect that craftsperson, because without them, nothing gets built.
So what is your specialty, and how did you learn to love whatever you have settled on?
Well, we're a commercial contractor. We do parking decks, office buildings, college buildings. We're doing a new cyclorama for the Atlanta History Center. We do airport work. We were partners on the new Atlanta Falcons Mercedes-Benz Stadium. We've done just a lot of good, neat projects over the last 30 years. And the way I started being in love with this when I was a kid. So I'm one of the few people who I believe is actually doing what they wanted to do since they were a kid. So it wasn't hard for me to learn to love it. I probably enjoy it more now because I'm helping that next generation of builders prepare. And I've had people who work for me who now have their own businesses, and I still mentor them. So it's fun to see that next group. You know, I'm a young 62. I'm still very active, but I also realize I've been doing this quite a while, and I'm now the old guy usually in the meeting. So it's kind of funny to see how quick those tables turn.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm beginning to love those years too, because I'm calling them my wisdom years. You know,
right.
This is the time that all the things that you've learned over the years, you get to sit back and say, okay, I know where you're going and I can help you get there. Or have you thought about it this way? So to me, these are good years in order to feel that you've accomplished something over the years. Now, when you were talking about your knowing that you wanted to do this from a child, I tend to think or have a belief that we need to pay attention to little people very early on, because I have a similar story. The first memory that I have is crawling under my grandmother's bed and pulling out an old cigar box with letters and photographs and a lock of her sister's hair and old stamps and what have you. And so that you know, that's who I am today. I love old stories. I love old photographs. I love telling what makes a person who they are, and the unique things about them that could motivate someone else. When I decided to write my first book, I went to talk to someone who happened to be in the industry, and I was trying to decide if I wanted to really do this. And she said, Ursula, it's not so important how many lives that you affect, but that you affect lives. So in the industry that I'm in, and in capturing that story and sharing the story, if one person walks up to me and say, I went and talked to my grandmother this time, and got her story, and then I could, that person can share it with the next generation, and maybe the little architect, knowing your story, will decide to go ahead and go to school and do that. So if you affect one life, then it's worth it. And so the reason I say all that is that I was 4 or 5 years old, and it's still who I am. So a lot of times when you're looking at little people, I think we need to pay attention to what they're saying and what they're doing and what they're saying that they love, because they're serious. I mean, we can mold them out or twist them out of it, but whatever they're saying at 4 or 5 years old is at least giving you an indication of what they're good at, what they want to do, and maybe you can expose them to different things. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, a couple things. One, I think we have to be very, very careful trying to children too early on what they want to be. I think one of the best things we can do is provide opportunities and freedom for them to think, navigate what they want to do, test the waters and some things. One of the things I think that's still kind of difficult in our American school system, we still make a child choose between vocational ed or college prep. Most school systems, you can't mix the two classes. So we make people decide too early their career path versus letting them experience different opportunities, different classes, voc ed, college prep. Because college isn't for everybody. There's nothing wrong with that. Like I said, I know some folks who finished high school, went on to trade school, and doing extremely well financially and in their career. So I think the best thing we can do is support children, but don't make them feel like they have to make a decision right away.
And I agree with you. And I guess what I was somewhat saying is that we, in that same process, pay attention to what they'd like, because that may give you a window into the kinds of things that you might want to expose them to, that they have no real idea about the world and how it really works. But if you see that they are interested, then, like you said, take them to something so that they can really see what it's all about.
Right.
Yeah. But and now that I say that, I don't know if someone had taken me to a museum at that point in time if I would appreciate it either, because I hated history when I was coming up. But
well, that's what I'm saying.
I
think we have to expose them, but not force them. And I think that's where we can get in trouble as parents, caregivers, aunts, uncles, whatever. We tend to want to make the decision for kids or tell them what they need to decide. And often... You there?
Yes.
Okay, I'm not sure what happened. I had lost you for a second.
Okay.
We okay?
Yes. So you were saying?
Oh, I said we have to really give children the opportunity to have free will to make choices. I think the best thing we can do is to give them the knowledge, share our knowledge, but give them exposure. I think one of the biggest things that I think is important in a child's life is this exposure to different things. And that doesn't mean having a lot of money or spending a lot of money, just to museums, to things that they seem to have a desire for, helping and doing whatever we can to have them, certain people, if it's helpful, or provide certain books. Or I think a lot of times the biggest thing we can do is just say encouraging words to a kid. Not what you can't do versus telling them, yeah, you can do that.
I totally agree with that, because the one line that my grandmother said to me, and I know it's not unique to her, but it felt like that to me, but she would always tell me that I was blessed. And so what that meant was, as I grew older, if times are bad, this too will pass. And if times were good, well, like grandma said, I'm blessed. And so
right.
If you believe it, you make it happen.
Right. That is very
so
true.
I understand you have children or a child. So tell us about
children. I have a 33-year-old son and a 31-year-old daughter. They're both in the business. They're both recently were made vice presidents of the company. And I will say this, they both have been as they would say, fired once at the company to help them understand you need to take this serious. And they took it serious after Mom and I decided, you know what, why don't you guys go see what's really going on in the world? And then if you're serious, let us know. So they both went out there and realized, hey, we got something here we can build on, and they're really digging in now and getting it done. I'm very proud of them.
So what is it really like to have family in the business? What are some of the ups and the downs and the advice that you have for anybody that anyone that's considering doing that?
Well, first of all, again, as I said earlier, you have to give them the freedom. And that's what I did. Both my kids, I always hoped they would want to be in it, but throughout their life, all I told them was, I just want you to be happy in what you do. Don't do this for me. I'm living my dreams. You got to find out what it is that you want. And fortunately, they did, but, you know, they worked a few other jobs, and they realized this is what they want to do. And it's always going to be tough, but fortunately for me, I am one of those folks who wants to get out the day-to-day. I do want to spend time doing other things. I'm very involved in other things. I'm the president of the board for the Atlanta Area Boy Scouts. I'm on the national board for Boy Scouts. I'll be the Rotary president for our club in 2019. I'll be the first African-American president for the Associated General Contractors Georgia chapter in 2020. So I have quite a few things. And I also am heavily involved in working with survivors of childhood sexual abuse. I am a survivor myself, which I kept hidden for 40-something years. I have a website. It's called moodyspeaks.com. It's been read in 120 countries. So I'm very vocal in helping those who are suffering in silence realize they don't have to suffer in silence, and they can still do incredible things with their lives regardless of what we've been through. So I have quite a bit that I'm involved with.
Well, you just touched on a couple of things that are near and dear to my heart. When you talk about suffering in silence, I know at least two loved ones that were very close to me that had nervous breakdowns. And
right.
As it turns out, both of those people had lifelong secrets. And so I've come to believe those secrets could actually kill you.
In 1992, my business was 4 years old, and that was the first time I said out loud to anyone, I told my wife what had happened to me. And within about 3 months, I started having panic attacks, and I actually had a complete nervous breakdown, but I could not stop because my business was only 4 years old. Fortunately, God took care of me. My wife's a nurse. And somehow we, with God's grace, we got through it, and I was able to get proper counseling, understand how all this tied together.
Mm-hmm.
And it still took me another 20 years before I spoke publicly about what happened. I would tell people in private, but we didn't talk about it. And once I got to a certain stage of life, I realized it was very important to speak up about mental health, such as anxiety, panic attacks, what childhood sexual abuse traumas like. And it just made me get very, very comfortable in speaking up, because I know it's making a difference to people.
Well, I know that to be absolutely true, because my first book I wrote for the first time about my mother who was mentally ill. And when I wrote that, it was like total freedom, because I realized
right.
that, you know, the world didn't crash in on me and people didn't turn me away. They didn't hate me or whatever. Nothing happened except I felt freer. And I had carried that for 40 years of being ashamed, of being afraid that it was going to happen to me. It was like a burden just totally was lifted because I wrote those words, published those words, and then life went on. To my amazement, life continued.
And that's probably one of the best things I got. I was very concerned to ever speak out about being sexually abused and dealing with anxiety from it because, you know, to everybody else, my life seemed, you know, perfect. You know, I went to college, played football in college, you know, this frat guy, you know, Omega Psi Phi fraternity, and I did all the stuff that everybody else did, but I was carrying that deep burden of the secret of being sexually abused. So I realized, you know, too many people suffer in silence and will start, and they take destructive lifestyles. And I just wanted to speak up to help those realize they were not alone, because too many people feel they are alone, so therefore they just keep it to themselves. So it's been incredible. I speak all over the country on that topic and of survivor and thriving and not letting our past control our present and future.
Well, I'm going to ask you a question right now, and since this is pre-recorded, if you don't want to answer it, I can cut it out. But if you do, it will be something that I personally am very interested in, and I suspect other people would be too. When you said that you either almost had a nervous breakdown or
no,
did.
I said I
and
did
so,
have one.
You did have one. So my question is.
I had a nervous breakdown, yes.
And since this happened to my mother, I am absolutely curious as to what that feels like.
Well, for me, I had a really bad panic attack. I was out of town at a meeting. They took me to the emergency room. And they said nothing was wrong. It's the second time it happened. And when I came back to the hotel room, I started getting uncontrollable shakes, crying uncontrollably. I was just like all the pressure I'd been hiding of sexual abuse for 26 years just was released. And I just emotionally was broken, but I could still run my business. I could still do the things I had to do. But I was in doing a lot of counseling and healing and resting. It was tough, but fortunately I had a strong support group and my inner drive was strong. But I didn't have any other like depression or anything. I just had developed anxiety, and it was like a pressure cooker that you remember the pressure cooker when it would rattle when it was.
Mm-hmm. I do.
It's like I had all that I had pent up. And that's really what it felt like for me. There, you know, I had a breakdown, but it might not have been to the level some other people have.
Yeah.
But it was enough to where I had uncontrollable, couldn't stop crying, and just wanted to get 5 drive, and that was probably the longest 5 hours of my life in 1999.
I saw something in real life, and then I just saw it on television just a couple of days ago. But I was driving down the street, and the reason I'm saying this is because you said yours may not have been to the level of some, but I was driving down the street, and traffic had been stopped facing me. It was on a two-way street, one lane each. And as I got closer, I realized that there was a person sitting in the middle of the street in lotus position. I mean, she was just sitting
that's
in the middle of the street.
That's something totally different than mine. Was an anxiety kind of stress breakdown where my body just got in uncontrollable shakes and crying. There are other people that have psychotic breakdowns, and I'm not a psychologist or a professional, but mine wasn't at that level. I just had that anxiety, emotional type, I guess they say over-the-top breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
But I could still function, still run my business. I was just from anxiety.
Mm-hmm. So, and in fact, the fact that you could pick up and go on is just fascinating. So what would you say some of the things are that are most exhilarating and motivating and encouraging as you progress in your industry?
Well, to me now is, you know, getting projects that are fun and really helping that next generation get ready. That's the real deal to me, is seeing young people grow, thrive, get opportunities in this industry, especially those who look like me, which are people of color. Because so often we don't get certain opportunities. We might get jobs, but we don't get opportunities for really.
Okay, you're breaking up a little bit. I didn't understand what you just said.
All right. I said, can you hear me now okay?
Yes, yes.
Okay. I said, when I came along and started my business, I had never been hired than a project manager. So I had a lot of trial and error. Fortunately, I had people that I could call on for advice. But so often, people of color in construction don't get a lot of the opportunity to really see how all the pieces of a business go together. So one of the things we try and do is let people really see all the pieces of a business, because that's critical to run a company.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's the answer to what I was going to ask you next. Given the award-winning status that you have and how big you are, what are the keys to getting to be as big as you are?
Patience. Not doing it for the money, because it takes a while to make money. Thriving to be the best that you can be. But you really got to believe you can do the impossible. For me, I exceeded my dreams. So I tell people to really dream big. I didn't dream anywhere near big enough, because you got to remember, when I came along, I had never even seen anybody who looked like me run a construction company. It wasn't until I was in my 20s that I, you know, probably met a couple. But before that, you know, I knew some who might have been, you know, subcontractors, but I never personally knew any major black contractors. So one of the things I think is important is for as many of us as possible to make ourselves available the best we can, so other people can just see us and know we exist and hear us.
The question that I have now, switch gears just a little bit, is about women in the industry. What's
yes.
your observation, and where do you see it going, and what are some tips that you might offer to help women become more successful?
Well, I would say our company personally probably is majority women, or close, or at least 50-50 in key positions. I have found women to be extremely well prepared to be in construction. And I think they just got to keep looking for opportunities. And when they get them, you know, break that stereotype that exists. But I see quite a few women in construction now compared to when I first got in. Pretty much every job I'm on or we're doing, there are women in key spots on those projects. But, you know, Atlanta's a unique place, too. So I can't
okay.
speak of other places in the country, but Atlanta, you find a lot of women in construction and in key spots.
So what is so different about Atlanta? Because when I was in school, the students from Atlanta used to say, I'm from L.A. I said, what? Lovely Atlanta. So why do y'all like Atlanta so much?
Atlanta, you know, I think goes back to Maynard Jackson, the first black mayor. He did something that was very important. He made sure people of color got opportunities. And I always stress the word opportunities. He did not guarantee you work. What he made sure was, if you were serious about this, that people of color and females would get a fair opportunity and would have to be included. And basically what I always tell people, it was up to each individual once you got that opportunity. And that's anything in life. It's what you do with it. I mean, you have to be willing that you get an opportunity to knock it out the park and then build on that. But Atlanta also is home of Dr. Martin Luther King. The civil rights movement was very big here. And the business community got it pretty good here in Atlanta and understood it's better. It's not that it's perfect, but they got it. It was better to have inclusion than to fight it. And those who got it have done extremely well. Those who have fought it had to also have some they ended up kind of losing out in business. Or they just went into a different arena. But Atlanta's just, it's a special place.
So what is the opportunity of today nationwide? Where do you think we can best capitalize on the current situations, opportunities, conditions, whatever it is, as you see it today?
If I could give you an answer, I would be living on an island because I'd be wealthy. I could probably tell you the lottery numbers. I mean, I have no idea what the future holds. You know, the economy's doing okay, but I'm still scared. But that's just me. I tend to be a little bit more worrisome. But I couldn't give you or your listeners an answer that I could feel comfortable telling them what the future holds. The only thing I would say about the future is always be prepared. Don't be afraid. Don't let imaginary fear stop you. You have to push yourself. Fight through those fears, those fears that creep up that says you can't do this, you won't do that, or the naysayers who say certain things to you. So I think it's very important that we understand that we cannot allow fear to stop us, but we cannot predict the future. You just got to keep going and being prepared.
Wow. On that note, then what I'm going to ask you is, would you share with us the things that I have not gotten as a result of questions that I've asked you? But what are some things that you simply thought you might talk about that maybe I haven't asked about so far, or you just want to share as we close the program out?
Now, one of the things that I've come to appreciate as I age is how much we learn on this journey of life. The way I thought at 20 is totally different than I did at 40, and even greater change now that I'm in my 60s. It's just what I guess it's, for me, it's more what I say at peace, because once you get to a certain age, you start realizing, as they say, I have more road behind me than I have in front of me. So I want to make more of my time meaningful. I'm hoping that I'll be in position to share my wisdom to help others learn earlier the things I wish I had learned earlier, you know, that took me too long to learn. And I think one of the biggest things is you got to dream big, but you got to be willing to put the work in. You got to be prepared. You got to do it right. Don't try and cut corners. Give back and expect nothing in return. And most importantly, have fun. You got to have fun with this. Whatever it is you want to do, you have to have fun because you're going to have tough times. And I think the most important thing I share with people, we are so much stronger than we realize. And we're all going to go through something in our life that's going to knock us to our knees. And we're going to find out we are so much stronger than we realize. So that's pretty much what I would have to say.
All right. Well, what I'd like to say, and on behalf of NABWIC, thank you very much for sharing your wisdom with us today. I've learned a lot. I've enjoyed listening to your story or your life story, and would love to have you come back another time.
Sure.
Thank
I
you
even
so
wrote
very
a
much.
Book. Yeah. Yeah. And I
go ahead.
Wrote a book. Yeah, I wrote a book. It's called Fighting Through the Fear. my journey of healing through childhood sexual abuse. You can buy it on Amazon or you can buy it at moodyspeaks.com. And it's been doing quite well. It's a business book and a book on what it was like to have to go through childhood sexual abuse. But I spent very little time on the actual abuse. I probably spent two sentences. I talk more about what it's like to have to build a business while trying to also deal with living with a secret and a trauma and also dealing with anxiety, but just how well we can deal with all these things and just do incredible things with our lives.
Amazing. Thank you. And we will check that out.
All right.
All right. Thank you once again. And to my listening audience, thank you for listening to us and sharing the moment. And come back next week. Take care.
This concludes our show. Thank you for listening to NABWIC, the National Association of Black Women in Construction. For more information about NABWIC and our membership, please visit us on the web at www.nabwic.org. We are the voice of Black women in construction. Have a great and prosperous day.